Hello, everyone. Before we start today's podcast, some exciting news for you. You can experience the Inside Politics podcast live in Dublin on May 16th when Hugh Linehan, Jennifer Bray and I will be joined by Cliff Young of Ipsos, one of America's top pollsters, to talk about the US election, our own local and European elections and much more. It's a breakfast event kicking off at 8 a.m. in Trinity College. If you'd like to attend, you can get tickets at irishtimes.com/events. That's irishtimes.com/events. I hope we see lots of you there.
Hello there, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. I am joined today by our former political editor and current columnist, Stephen Collins, and also by historian Kieran Meehan. And they're both here to discuss their new book, Saving the State, Fine Gael from Collins de Varadkar, which I've been reading over the last week as a sort of calming counterpoint to the high-stakes drama currently playing out in the United States. The book tells the story of Fine Gael from its roots in the aftermath of the treaty and the Civil War right up to its historic decision this year to go into coalition with Fianna Fáil. And I want to delve into some of the history in a moment. But first, you're both very welcome.
Thanks, Hugh.
Thanks.
And maybe first, Stephen, before we go into that history, maybe you could help me with a problem I've suffered for years when I'm talking to people from outside the country and trying to describe to them what the Irish political landscape is and give them a capsule version of what each of the political parties stands for. If you were doing such a thing with a political scientist from another planet, what would be the capsule version of what Fine Gael is?
Well, I would say for a start, we don't operate on the European left-right spectrum, even though that is breaking down at the moment. I've often, when I'm speaking to people from outside the country, compared it to American politics. It's more like Republicans and Democrats. The two big parties, well, the two formerly two big parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, were broad coalitions of different interests. I would say Fine Gael would probably describe in European terms as centre-right, and Fianna Fáil as centre-left. But both would contain people who have very different views. Fianna Fáil would be more socially conservative. So Fine Gael might be centre-right, but would be more socially liberal. So I would say the two big parties, they share a fairly common analysis of the economy. They both believe in a mixed economy. Neither are right-wing in the sense of being Thatcherite, believing that the state should not interfere in people's lives. Both, I think, believe in a mixed economy and that there should be a safety net and that we should have a decent welfare system insofar as we can afford one. So that's a very, very rough guide, Hugh, and it doesn't really get down to it because the names of the parties confuse outsiders, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And actually, this is why, going back to the title of our book, they originated in the Civil War. They originated in the independence movement in 1922 when it fractured, when it divided over whether or not we should agree a treaty with the UK in terms of the form of independence we were going to have. So they've come from that route. So they both come from a similar route. They both share economic views, but they've been essentially competing for power for the past century or so.
I mean, I might dig into the other part of that in a little while, which is, I suppose, what is vaguely described as the culture, the different culture of the different parties as it's developed over the years. But Kira, just to go back then to the 1920s, because I think a lot of people think of Fine Gael as a party that started, albeit under another name, in the wake of the treaty and the Civil War when Cumann na n-Éill was founded. But Cumann na n-Éill, although it may be the dominant strand, is not the only strand that feeds into the party that we now call Fine Gael that was formed in the early 1930s.
Yes, that's correct. I think when people talk about the creation of Fine Gael, they often see it as a rebranding of the Cumann na n-Éill party. But actually, there is a much wider kind of pool that creates Fine Gael. And that includes, obviously, the blue shirts, which is the most contentious element, but also the legacy of the Farmers' Party and also the Irish Parliamentary Party tradition as well. You have Frank McDermott's National Centre Party that becomes a component part of Fine Gael, bringing in a much longer tradition that, as I say, goes back into the farming community, goes back into the Irish Parliamentary Party. And I think because of the controversy over the blue shirts, that element tends to be forgotten, although John Bruton has been very active in trying to highlight the links that he sees between Fine Gael and the tradition going back to John Redmond and constitutional nationalism.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll come to the blue shirts in a moment, but I mean, I should hold up my hand and declare my own gene pool here. My own grandfather was a member of the National League, which was the Redmondite party, which won some seats in the Dáil in 1927. And he and pretty much all of them ended up in the new Fine Gael party. So there is that tradition of the remnants of the Irish constitutionalism after independence. And I suppose also what might be called, in the case of my grandfather, for example, who was elected in Donegal, also the Protestant vote, what had formerly been the Unionist vote.
Yeah, you see that with people like Major Brian Cooper, for example, who become very heavily involved with Cumann na Gael. The Protestant element, I suppose, in some ways drops out after 1930s, but certainly found a natural home within Cumann na Gael and then later in Fine Gael. So there is certainly a lot of continuity between the members of Cumann na Gael and Fine Gael, but as you rightly say, other key characters from the constitutional tradition finding a home within Fine Gael as well.
Let's go into the blue shirt thing with a little bit more detail, Stephen, if you wouldn't mind, because it seems to me this is the quite large skeleton that still rattles around in the historical closet of Fine Gael, and I'm not sure that they've still fully come to terms with it or figured out how to both acknowledge it, own it, and dispense with it.
Yeah, well, the blue shirts arose from a very specific historical period, and Ciara probably would know more about this than I would. But it arose after the 1932 election, when the IRA campaigned for Fianna Fáil very forcefully. And then there was an election in 1933, in January 33. Some of the Cumann na Gael meetings at that stage were broken up. No free speech for traitors was a Republican slogan. So in order to try and protect their right to free speech, supporters of Cumann na Gael, some of them formed the Army Comrades Association, which then transformed into the Blue Shirts. So what started, I think, as an understandable, probably justifiable defence, then turned into an organisation which had the trappings of some of the fascist movements in Europe, and certainly wearing the blue shirt. I mean, there were the black shirts and the brown shirts. Europe appeared to be going fascist in the early 1930s. In the way the world appears to have been going populist over the last few years. So the blue shirts then became quite a significant force, challenging the government, going outside the law. And it certainly was for a party that had founded the institutions of the state, Cumann na Gael, to merge with the blue shirts and the centre party was certainly an embarrassment. It didn't last very long. Eoghan Duffy, who was the leader of the Blue Shirts, a bit like Donald Trump, he was charismatic, but he didn't have staying power, or he was a very poor leader. And there were some elements of the Cumann na Gael who were very unhappy with the association with the Blue Shirts. So were people in the Centre Party. So they got rid of O'Duffy, but there's no disguising the fact that they dealt with them. O'Duffy was a significant part of the Fine Gael history. And yes, Fine Gael in the subsequent generations have found it difficult to deal with that. Were they fascists? Were they not? I think on the overall argument I would accept would be that they weren't really fascist, but they were going down a dangerous direction. But if you look at subsequent history, when it came to the Second World War, I mean, Fine Gael did not support the Nazis. In fact, Fine Gael was accused of not being enthusiastic enough about Irish neutrality. And in fact, James Dillon left Fine Gael to support the Allied cause, whereas the people who supported the Nazis were some of the extreme Republicans. With Sinn Féin were on the Nazi side rather than Fine Gael. So, but nonetheless, the party has had difficulty explaining it. I remember years ago during the Garda Fitzgerald period, and Garda Fitzgerald would certainly have had no truck with the blue shirts, with that element of their history. But I remember there was some commemoration I covered as a reporter, where James Dillon addressed a meeting of Fine Gael people in Dublin, I think it was in the Mansion House, and having talked about how the great history of the party, he then said, "When we should not forget the blue shirts." Now Garrett was on the at the top table beside him and looked particularly uncomfortable, and James Dillon went back on the thing. We had to defend our right to free speech. If we didn't didn't defend the right to free speech, we wouldn't have democracy. So he was pitching the blue shirts as actually essential to the preservation of democratic norms, which I think was gilding the lily more than a bit. But I think it does show you, and certainly that night, you could see that Fitzgerald was very uncomfortable. So they've never, it is part of the, it is a skeleton in the cupboard. I don't know if many people nowadays, your average voter, pays much attention to it or not. In the old days, blue shirt used to be hurled across the floor of the Dáil by Fianna Fáil people as a term of insult. In more recent decades, I think even Fine Gael people themselves refer to each other as the blue shirts. So I think the fascist resonance would have faded.
Yeah, it still resonates a little bit for me. It also goes very much, Ciara, contrary to what I would take to be the overall thesis of the book, and it's implicit in the title as well, is that, you know, from establishing the original institutions of the state in the years after independence through to that very key moment when power is handed over to Fianna Fáil without bloodshed in 1932, which was no mean thing actually, and was really what really established the new democratic state, I think, fundamentally, that Fine Gael has been at the heart of preserving the legitimacy of the Irish state, which is one of the remarkable achievements of this country since independence, unlike many, many other European countries which fell prey to totalitarian or anti-democratic forces at one point or another.
Yeah, the title of our book reflects Fine Gael's own sense of self and it's the way that it sees itself as the defender or the savior of the state at certain points. But I think as well, what's important to remember about the blue shirts, and the historian Mike Cronin has done a lot of work around this as well, is that despite having some very obvious trappings of the continental fascist movement, although, and again, there were some minorities within the blue shirt supporters who were in favour of this. Overall, though, their policies didn't promote any disestablishment of the Dáil or the Senate as it was at the time. And that's quite an important thing to remember, because they weren't seeking to overthrow democracy in that way. So the blue shirts, on the face of it, and when compared with continental fascism, yes, certainly seems to go in flying the face of this idea of Fine Gael defending the institutions of the state, but it is more nuanced than that. I would also say that Ona Duffy, and I say this sort of half flippantly, perhaps if we were still alive, might get a kick out of the idea of being on the cover of a book called Saving the State, because when he was Garda Commissioner, he submitted multiple reports to the cabinet about what he considered to be degenerate elements of society. He was very motivated with keeping a chaste and a pure society and so on. Now, I don't agree with some of the things that he was arguing at the time, but he certainly saw himself as someone who was trying to save the soul of Ireland as well.
Well, he did, of course, you know, go off to Spain to fight for Franco subsequently.
He did. And I think after he was removed as the leader of, as the president of Fine Gael, he really embraced fascist ideals then at that point. You could see the descent into it prior to that. But afterwards, he became much more kind of authoritarian in the way, in his views and kind of the things that he expressed. But again, kind of just to go back to what Mike Cronin and even Maurice Manning have pointed out in their histories of the blue shirts, that there is a disconnect at times between what O'Duffy believes and what the maybe grassroots blue shirts were thinking at the time as well.
Now, Stephen, when that transfer of power to Fianna Fáil happened in 1932, Fine Gael entered one of its several long years in the wilderness periods. It would be 16 years before it was back in government in 1948. And then again, after 1957, there was another 16 years that it was out of power. And then, of course, more recently, in direct living memory, it had another long, dark winter from 1997 to 2011. That is Fine Gael, to some degree, defined by its own failure to be in power as much as it should have been.
Yeah, well, there was a huge period when Fine Gael wasn't in power, and when Fine Gael, certainly you could describe the party as a failure. It hung on as the main opposition party, and it appeared to have formed a kind of a mentality that it was happy enough to be in opposition. But there were long periods out of government, and it only managed to get back into government in coalition with either a number of other parties or with the Labour Party. The Labour Party was always its kind of more reliable ally to go into government with. But Fianna Fáil were the dominant party in Ireland for almost 80 years. Fianna Fáil was the biggest party. Fianna Fáil was able to get an overall majority up to the early 1980s. And Fine Gael really struggled. And I think that's one of the reasons Fine Gael, certainly in more modern times, changed its leader so often. They were searching for a formula. So it was a bit like in the old Celtic times, they decapitate the leader as an excuse for failure. Rather than trying to build the organisation. Quite often it was a chaotic organisation. In some ways, it reflected maybe the background. Fianna Fáil had a cross-class support. Fianna Fáil was very strong in working class areas. It had a strong middle-class base as well. Fine Gael tended to retreat to its supporters among the professional classes and the larger farmers, who in a sense weren't as hungry. As long as the state was being run in a reasonably effective manner, as Fianna Fáil did manage to do it a lot of the time, they didn't really have the hunger for power, and they were content to be critics of the Fianna Fáil government rather than having the ambition to be in government themselves. I think it wasn't until Gareth Fitzgerald really modernised the organisation in the late 1970s and Fine Gael saw themselves as challenging Fianna Fáil to be the biggest party in the state. They almost made it, and then collapsed and fell away again. And from 1987 until 2011, if that whole period they were only in power for 2.5 years almost by accident. And it was only in 2011, for the first time in its history as under the label Fine Gael, that it actually became the largest party in the state. And that's because Fianna Fáil had made such an enormous mess of the economy at the time. And since that big triumph in 2011, the party has struggled again. It's held onto power for far longer than it ever has before, but its vote and its number of seats have been in decline. So the party has had a lot of challenges. But one thing I would say is that the loyalty that Fine Gael still commands, despite its ineffectual organisation quite often, was that when in 2002 in particular, when Fine Gael had a disastrous election, I remember lots of people were writing the obituary. I remember as a journalist, a lot of the political colleagues wrote the obituary of Fine Gael and said it couldn't survive, it had no function anymore, and yet it clung on. So there is a loyalty there to the notion of what Fine Gael is about among a number of people that was strong enough to keep the party alive and to keep it in the game until the tide turned and was able to come back into power.
Yeah, a lot of what Stephen says there is very interesting to me, Keir. There's some very striking vignettes in the book. There's one of John A. Costello in 1948, when he's on the day that he is about to be elected Taoiseach. And he was a part-time politician, and to some extent he was a part-time Taoiseach. He continued his activities down the law library, and he's down the forecourts on that day, and he bumps into, I think it's Tom O'Higgins, and he offers him a ministership on the day, which speaks to a certain kind of shambolic amateurism, or maybe also, I sense in what Stephen is saying there, a sense of kind of noblesse oblige, that they're not really professional politicians because they are embedded in the country's elite. It almost struck me as a version of more recent examples of senior Fine Gael politicians WhatsApping their pals in the medical profession. So if you're so rooted in the law library or the higher parts of the medical profession, you don't perhaps need to get around to do some of the dirty tricks which they were always accusing Fianna Fáil, sometimes with some justification, of, because you have your hands on the levers of power already.
Yeah, absolutely. I think describing Fine Gael probably up until the Fitzgerald era as an amateur party rings true. And it's not just in the law library that, you know, you've got members of the parliamentary party who are active in business as well. As you said, they're well connected and well networked with many kind of key players in society. So they have a degree of influence outside of the parliament. And I think that's partially reflected in the fact that if you look at the minutes of the parliamentary party at the time, there are conversations around people not turning up to vote, general lack of attendance, which of course then feeds into kind of a lack of interest in developing policy as well. So for a lot of the politicians of Fine Gael for many decades, the operation of a political party wasn't really a priority for them. And you can see the frustration that causes for some of the younger generation, like Declan Costello, when he formulates his Just Society ideas, which are not just about trying to create a better society for Ireland, but also about trying to reinvigorate Fine Gael and inject some professionalism into the party. But certainly that part-time nature of how it operates from the leadership right down, and a contentment in being in opposition almost definitely influences its performance at that time.
Yes, Stephen, there's a sort of recurring theme. You see it in the 1950s when the country is really on its knees economically and people are starting to think about what's going to be required. And T.K. Whittaker is a rising star in the civil service, and ultimately he will drive the kind of the fairly profound change in public policy, which will lead to greater economic growth. But that doesn't actually happen until Fianna Fáil get back into power, until Sean Lamass takes those on boards. So the idea, the germ of an idea might happen in a Fine Gael-led administration, but it's Fianna Fáil who do it. And in a way, you could argue, and we could argue for ages about the various merits of the various economic programmes, but Fine Gael wanted to do certain things in the 1980s and was constrained from doing so. And some of those things were done by Fianna Fáil with some success then when Fianna Fáil came into power. So there is a sort of recurring pattern there, isn't it? Fine Gael might have an idea, but they're not able to execute it.
Yeah, well, there is. Fine Gael might have had an idea. Actually, the second Fine Gael inter-party government from 54 to 57 was in power at a very difficult time, economic time. But the Minister for Finance at the time, Gerard Sweetman, who was a tough nut and who brought in some austerity budgets, he did, as you say, appoint T.K. Whittaker. But he did more than that. They also brought in the export tax relief, which turned into our current 12.5% corporate tax relief. And Sweetman and Whittaker had the idea of trying to open up the Irish economy to dismantle protectionism and involve us in the free trade area in the Western world, which was the economy of Europe. Most European countries were roaring ahead in the 50s, and we were languishing in outdated policies. Fine Gael's problem was that it didn't have a majority. It was in coalition with the Labour Party, and the Labour Party had some good ideas and some very good ideas in terms of social housing. And the Labour Party had many achievements, but neither of those two parties ever got credit for the achievements they had in the period because things were so tough. Fianna Fáil came in and effectively implemented Fine Gael policy. Lamass built on Sweetman's policy, and Whittaker was the person who drove it through. And as you say, in 1987, it was a similar situation. From 1982 to 87, the Fine Gael Labour government struggled with a huge national debt. They actually, Cara Fitzgerald deserves more credit than they get. He's often accused of actually completely failing on the economy. He stopped it getting worse, and he stopped it going over the edge of the cliff. But of course, in politics, that's not good enough. And he couldn't do any more because his coalition partners, Labour, would have walked out on him because Labour was riven with dissension at the time. So Fine Gael in government wasn't able to deliver. But they put the budget, the 1987 budget, which John Bruton drafted and which Labour left government on, was actually the budget that Ray McSharry and Fianna Fáil brought in, and it got huge credit for the turnaround in the economy. So I think the one occasion when the opposite, if you like, happened was during our more recent financial crisis, when the country again was on the edge of the precipice, and it was actually Fianna Fáil who were responsible for the country and for the creating the conditions which led to the financial crash. But Fianna Fáil took enough of the emergency measures, tough, very harsh, very unpopular measures, to pull it back from the edge of the cliff. So Fine Gael came in, Enda Kenny and Eamon Gilmore, and they effectively implemented the policies that Fianna Fáil were committed to, and also they were committed to because of the European bailout. That was the first time that actually Fine Gael were in a position to implement the policies of Fianna Fáil and get some credit, if not an awful lot, for actually the economic turnaround which came in the wake of 2010 and 11. So, and then again, of course, then we ended up with the situation which we thought we'd never see, when Fianna Fáil and Fianna Gael coming edging closer together in 2016 with this with an arrangement, because they had some a government had to be put in place, the confidence and supply arrangement was something new, but actually going into formally going into coalition this year, which I think has marks a huge shift in Irish politics, that the two parties who 100 years ago fought a civil war, as you said earlier on, the handover of power in 32 was an essential facet of our democracy, but now the two parties are sharing power together, mainly because, of course, they have to, because the alternative, Sinn Féin, became a rival, and the most recent election transformed Irish politics yet again and forced the two old campaigners to come together again.
And we might talk a little bit about the potential future for the party, but maybe just to go back a little bit, the Just Society was already mentioned. This is a document that I've been aware of all my life. I've never read it, to be perfectly honest, but I know it kind of casts not a shadow, but it was deeply influential in the way that the party developed, certainly in the 70s and the 80s. And under Garrett Fitzgerald's leadership, and although I note in the book it's described as being, you know, perhaps not as important as people thought it was, but it did mark a shift on the, I suppose, the social policy side from what the party had been previously. It really was a conservative party, both socially and economically, in the 1920s and the 1930s, wasn't it, Ciarán? In fact, it was Fine Gael that implemented a lot of the confessional state elements of the new state in the 1920s, the basically being done what they were told by the bishops a lot of the time, strict censorship, the banning of divorce, various other kinds of things. Just Society kind of pointed another direction, which slowly became more and more important for the party.
Yeah, Hugh, first of all, I'd say that you're not on your own in not having read the document. There are plenty within the party and beyond who haven't read it either. The title, The Just Society, is a wonderful slogan and allows for people to speak to what they believe is in the document. The document itself, you're right, does represent a shift for Fine Gael, but it's not a particularly radical document, although it's quite lengthy. It is in keeping with thinking that's happening more broadly internationally at the time, a shift away from kind of church influence over the state and kind of greater say for people in determining what they want from politics. I think what it really did in terms of Fine Gael are two things. One is challenged the party to think about what it was. Declan Costello was very clear that Fine Gael could not continue with defining itself as not Fianna Fáil, and he wanted it to create an identity of its own. And you see Garrett Fitzgerald really doing that when he takes over leadership of the party. And the second thing that it did was to create an identity crisis, ultimately, because it did shift towards a more liberal understanding, which then Garrett built on with the constitutional crusade of the 1980s. And this kind of moved away from the conservative elements that had dominated Fine Gael, but not totally. And so you now have these kind of two ways of thinking about society that don't sit comfortably with each other. And that very much plays out during the Fitzgerald era and then afterwards as well, when Fine Gael are really in a crisis of identity. And you see that, as Stephen mentioned earlier, in terms of its tendency after Fitzgerald to then blame the leadership. And Olivia O'Leary said they became a leader serial killer with the people that are removed. So yeah, Costello's document casts this long legacy, but I don't think it was actually as influential in terms of policy as perhaps is sometimes suggested, but is very important in terms of shaping the party's mentality, if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, one of the things that strikes me about it is that the party, Stephen, has been constrained from coming out of the closet fully as the centre-right party, which you described it as at the top of this podcast. It seems uncomfortable with fully taking on that identity, and partly that may be due to the fact that it's always had to, when it has had the opportunity to go into government, it's almost always had to go into coalition with parties of the centre-left. But it's also, there's an element of kind of having its cake and eating it, and maybe that came to a head in the 1980s for a number of reasons, not least the fact that for the first time it was challenged from the right, I suppose, by the Progressive Democrats, who, I mean, were embodied in political terms mostly by former Fianna Fáil politicians, but who actually challenged Fine Gael more in terms of taking its vote and offering perhaps a more pro-free market, more right of centre position.
Yes, I think Fine Gael has been constrained by two things. One is, as you say, to get into government, they have been depending on the Labour Party, so there was no great incentive to shift to the right. Secondly, in Irish politics, whatever people actually, however they behave, a right wing is regarded as a bad thing, generally, whereas left wing is not an insult. Right wing is still an insult to a party, so Fine Gael don't want to identify too strongly. And in European terms, they're not very right wing, but they are part of the, again, we asked earlier on, where would your situation? They are part of the European People's Party group in the European Parliament, and they are the Christian Democratic parties. Some of those parties would have no difficulty describing themselves as conservative, if not right wing. I'd say conservative would be the label. But there are different elements in Fine Gael. I think people say, for instance, Pascal Dunhu has been arguing very strongly that Fine Gael is a centre party, that the centre is the future of politics, and that the centre has been challenged by both the hard right and the hard left, and that the wave of populism, left and right wing populism, can only be met by a strong centre ground. So he clearly, and he's one of the people who thinks about things in the party, he clearly sees Fine Gael very firmly in the centre and maybe slightly left. Leo Varadkar would be maybe in the centre and slightly right. And Leo Varadkar actually in the book, in an interview for the book, he did, when asking him about the future, he thought that Irish politics would become a bit like Dutch politics with a lot of parties roughly equal. But he saw the threat to Fine Gael in the future coming from a right-wing party, from a much more openly free market, low taxation type party like the PDs. And he thought that was their vulnerability if they didn't cater for that element of the electorate to some degree.
Because there is a gap in the market there, Stephen, isn't it? I mean, it is strange. I mean, it's not an unusual thing in any democratic country to have a party, you know, a relatively significant part of the political landscape occupied by a party that unabashedly describes itself as centre-right or conservative.
No, that's true. But in Ireland, there isn't a huge market for it. Even looking at Irish Times opinion polls are very interesting. When we ask questions like, do you want, which is more important, lower taxation or public services? The people who are most strongly in favour of public services and against lower taxation are the better off, the ABs. Are actually the more liberal. It's actually, if you go down, it's more working class voters who say they want lower taxation as a priority. So I'm not sure there's a huge market for a nakedly right wing individualistic style of politics. I think you could see a small handful of seats going to some party like that, but not very many. Not unless. As long as the economy continues to do all right, I'm saying that we're coming to COVID. We have no idea where this whole how COVID, the impact it's going to have on the economy. It could down the line cause enormous strains. And in those kind of strains, those situations, I think that's where new parties emerge. Back the PDs emerged in the 1980s when there was a huge crisis in economic management of the country, when Fine Gael wasn't able to deal with the problems, and Charlie Haughey in Fianna Fáil appeared not to even recognise the problems. So I think that gave an opening for the PDs. At the moment, I don't really see an opening for a strongly right-wing party as long as Fine Gael continues to cover its conservative flank.
Right, Ciara, we said earlier that Fine Gael, in the middle of the last century, tried to start defining itself as something more than not Fianna Fáil. But being not Fianna Fáil, I would suggest, is still part of the party's identity up until much more recently. But that has obviously become less important as Fianna Fáil itself has decreased dramatically in size and support. And in fact, in terms of the history of Fine Gael, the last decade has been a remarkable time because it's been in power for a far longer continuous period than at any other point in its history. And a lot of people are suggesting, as Stephen mentioned there, that the political landscape has now changed entirely from the bipolar one we were used to for most of the last century. And that in that situation, not Fianna Fáil is just not going to be an important part of the brand anymore, particularly when they're, as they are right now, in coalition. So what is the identity then? And is it possible that the new brand of Fine Gael is just that it's not Sinn Féin?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I wouldn't write off not Fianna Fáil entirely, because at the next election, if Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil aren't going to have another coalition, Fine Gael still needs to establish its identity, and, you know, needs to work for those votes. But it is interesting that in the last few years, and particularly the last few months leading up to the most recent election, that Fine Gael has obviously refocused its energies on Sinn Féin, criticising the party, trying to point out, you know, trying to, I suppose, question the legitimacy of the party and emphasising very heavily some of its longer history. And so, yeah, Fine Gael, I think, in the future will frame itself more in the context of Sinn Féin, and revert back to its own, again, to go back to the title of the book, and this sense of Fine Gael being the defenders of the state. So really framing the party in the context of democracy, you know, defending the democratic structures of the state over the time and attempting to delegitimize Sinn Féin.
I mean, Stephen, this is quite an old playbook, isn't it? I mean, you can look at posters from the 1932 election campaign, Fine Gael posters, and what they're saying about Fianna Fáil at the time, about the shadow of a gunman and it being, you know, extra-legal or extrajudicial activities. And those are exactly the same attacks that it's now making on Sinn Féin.
Yes, I think there is a bit of a difference, though, in the modern Sinn Féin. Fianna Fáil, and Seán Amass famously described them as a slightly constitutional party, but once Fianna Fáil entered the Dáil, they threw themselves full-time into politics. Sinn Féin, there are still questions about who runs Sinn Féin. Is it the Army Council of the IRA? In fact, it is the Army Council of the IRA. We've seen evidence of that over the last while. So I think Fine Gael's appeal to people is that it isn't, that it is maybe the bulwark against Sinn Féin. And Sinn Féin's economic policies would be very much on the populist left side of the equation. But I don't think it's the economic arguments that really go to the heart of it. I think it's the argument about the democratic standards and what kind of country people want. And I think it is interesting, all right, in recent opinion polls, although Fine Gael people need to take opinion polls with a huge grain of salt, because we've had elections in 2016 and 2020, and the party has been way below what it has achieved in some of the polls in between elections. But the positive side for Fine Gael is that a significant proportion of the electorate, and particularly the young electorate, do see Fine Gael as the alternative to Sinn Féin. There's a huge drift to Sinn Féin among the younger age groups, but there's also a consolidation and a rise in the Fine Gael vote, and Fianna Fáil is getting squeezed between the two parties. Fianna Fáil is losing support to Sinn Féin, and its old working class heartlands have gone to Sinn Féin. And it's losing some middle-class support to Fine Gael on the basis of Fine Gael is the party most likely to stop Sinn Féin. So I think, yeah, I think it's a fair point. But Fine Gael, I think this is what Pascal Donoghue is trying to do. He's trying to identify where it's not just we're an anti-Sinn Féin party. It's we stand for certain principles, and economic principles, social principles. And again, we shouldn't forget one of the things that has happened in Fine Gael over the last 10 years. It's become the socially liberal party. And it wasn't in its earlier manifestation. It was a socially conservative party. But it's a socially liberal party. I think it's tried plugged itself into the changing trends in Irish society, and I think that is partly why it is doing well in the polls. Whereas Fianna Fáil, by comparison, Fianna Fáil, the makeup of the Fianna Fáil vote is elderly. It reminds me, I worked in the Irish press in my early stages of my career, and they used to say the problem with the Irish press was the readers were dying off and were not being replaced. And I think that is Fianna Fáil's problem at the moment. Fine Gael is managing to replace members with a younger cohort, not just members, in voters and supporters. So, I think politics has been so volatile, it's impossible to judge where it's going to go. But I think Fine Gael is reasonably well positioned to survive into the future in a way you would have thought 2 decades ago that it was on its last legs.
And Ciara, isn't the real politic of this that Sinn Féin and Fine Gael have share a mutual objective, or they both benefit from the decline, and who knows if it's going to be the disappearance? Parties don't really seem to disappear, but the decline of Fianna Fáil benefits both Fine Gael and Sinn Féin, and in fact, a strong Sinn Féin benefits Fine Gael.
Yeah, as Stephen said, Fianna Fáil are losing votes to Fine Gael, but also losing them to Sinn Féin. And that creates space, I suppose, for Fine Gael to compete more actively for the Fianna Fáil vote. So were Fianna Fáil to disappear from the party political system, and I'm not convinced that they would, but certainly it seems likely that Fine Gael would hoover up quite a substantial portion of those votes, though many of the grassroots perhaps might not be willing to admit that themselves.
Just a last question, Stephen. Nearly a century on from the formation of Fine Gael's precursor, Cumann na Gael, what state do you think the party is in? Is it in good health? Do you think its future looks assured?
I think it's in reasonable health. I think it's, as I said, I think it's in a better position than you would have thought 2 decades ago when people were writing the party's obituary. It's got, it's a lot very, it's a young age group. Its ministers are relatively young. I think they are plugged into the way Irish society is going. So I think as a centre party, with maybe centre-right party, I think they do have a future. But one thing I think the most recent election showed us was how volatile the Irish electorate has become. Sinn Féin, the performance of Sinn Féin astonished everybody, including Sinn Féin for that matter, because they didn't run enough candidates and they would have certainly run far more if they'd known how well they were going to do. So predicting the future is a mug's game, really. I think I've got it wrong, like most other so-called pundits. But I would think Fine Gael is in a reasonably healthy position and is in a good position to survive for the next couple of decades.
Well, we shall leave it there. Just to say that Saving the State is published by Gill Books. Thanks to Stephen and to Kira for joining us here today. Thanks also to our producer, Declan Conlon. Remember that you can sign up for a subscription to the Irish Times at irishtimes.com/inside. And if you use that particular address, irishtimes.com/inside, they will know that we sent you there, and that helps us in our efforts to keep making this podcast a little bit better. So if you haven't done so already, we would really be delighted if you consider subscribing to the newspaper. And also, if you want to get in touch with us, we're always very pleased to hear from you. Just email us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. But until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.